This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
The views expressed in this podcast are the views of the expert interviewed and do not necessarily represent the views of Takeda Pharmaceutical Company Limited.
In clinical trials and drug development, study endpoints represent a crucial intersection of the interests of patients, clinicians, regulators, and payers. Many of today's conversations about the value of a therapy, whether it's patient value, clinical value, or payer value, begin in the crucible of study endpoints. I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of DIA Global Forum. I am joined today by an expert in this field, Michael Lees, who serves as Head of Value, Evidence, and Portfolio for Europe and Canada at Takeda Pharmaceuticals International GmbH in Switzerland. Michael also serves on the program committee for DIA's 2018 conference on advancing the science of study endpoints. Thank you for joining me today, Michael. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Alberto. Thanks for inviting me on.
Let's begin with a complex question, if you will. What are the clinical, regulatory, and value perspectives on the relationship between an endpoint and an outcome?
Thank you very much, Alberto. This is a great question. As you say, a complex question. I hope not to give too complex an answer. In my perspective, the relationship between an endpoint and an outcome is similar in many ways to the relationship between data and evidence. What we're looking at with an endpoint is what is measured in the clinical study or in the real-world research project. And an outcome is what does that actually mean for the people making the decision and for the people analyzing the research that's being conducted. So if you want to take a value perspective here, if you're looking at an endpoint such as an EQ5D, to use one of the favored endpoints of health technology assessment organizations, you're looking at what the scores of the EQ5D. An outcome, it's when you're translating this to meaning and to quality-adjusted life years, for example, applying it to the decision criteria that are used by organizations like NICE. I think you can take a similar approach if you're a clinical or regulatory expert. The transformation of the endpoint that's measured in a clinical study into something that has meaning when you're making a decision.
The subtext in what you just said is that actually an endpoint may not have much meaning in such decisions. Is that what you meant?
Not so much. I think that in order for an outcome to make more sense, it has to be based on something very strong as an endpoint. But I would almost see it in some ways as a building block, a foundation stone. In a different sort of sense, when you've got a surrogate endpoint, that may be necessary to conduct. It has a lot of meaning in a study situation, progression-free survival, response rate in oncology trials, such an example. But we would regard some of these as surrogates, which need to be then translated into something that is more of a final endpoint. You can't actually do anything important without the foundation point. But in order to help make a decision, particularly for authorities who look across different therapeutic areas, who look at many, many different health technologies, they need that to be translated into something that's more common for them to be able to make comparisons and to make decisions. So certainly not unimportant, certainly not without meaning, but a key building block to allow outcomes to be used as the basis for decision making.
In your opinion, do HTAs like NICE and others, do they sort of shun traditional endpoints or clinical trial endpoints and prefer to see outcome measures? I mean, endpoints are one thing, but what they really want to know is what is the outcome? Is that a fair perspective?
I think that there are so many different HTAs in the world, so many different approaches to life. I think if you're looking at those agencies that are looking at cost effectiveness as a key driver, again, I think the traditional study endpoint are regarded as the foundation stone for building an economic argument based on outcomes leading to an assessment of cost effectiveness. And so I think that they're regarded as a necessary but not sufficient requirement in order to make their assessment of value. If you're looking at agencies like the GBA in Germany or the Transparency Commission and in France, as long as the endpoints are patient relevant, I think that they're much more willing to use the traditional endpoints as the foundation stone for their decision making, because they're not taking that extra step of transformation into outcomes such as quality of life years or leading to a finding of cost effectiveness. So I think it does depend upon the health technology assessment agency. I think it does depend upon the payer organization as to what's their requirement. And that's one of the very interesting parts of building research, in that you do have to cater for these different requirements. That's even before you get to the regulatory authorities, to physicians and to other key decision makers.
You said that endpoints are necessary but not sufficient, if I understood you correctly. That being the case, are sponsors that show up at HTAs with clinical endpoints but not outcomes placing their product at risk of not being considered or approved by HTAs for reimbursement?
I would say, I mean, necessary but not sufficient in the eyes of some HTAs, not all, certainly. I think that, yes, there's always a risk that if you do not follow the requirements of the HTAs, which are actually quite well known and well publicized in many cases, that you are putting your product at risk of not achieving reimbursement at the level that you would like it to be achieved. I think that one of the key possibilities these days, particularly in the European sphere, is the possibility of getting early scientific advice with health technology assessment agencies as well as with regulatory agencies. Right. You have national level possibilities there. You can go and speak to NICE. You can go and speak to the TLV in Sweden. You can speak to the GBA in Germany. But also there's the prospect of going through the UNETA organization and doing parallel advice also with regulators. The reason I point this out is that each of these procedures gives you an opportunity as a sponsor to speak to the agencies while you're designing your clinical program and to understand what evidence requirements that there are. There are going to be some therapeutic areas where the more traditional study endpoints are the most appropriate way of measuring value, even at HTA level. There are going to be other therapeutic areas where the transformation into outcomes is considered to be more necessary. But there is an opportunity, particularly in Europe, as I've said, to get an insight before you make your design final.
Right. Scientific advice is usually and traditionally associated with regulatory agencies, not really with HTAs. So this is a relatively new phenomenon, seeking scientific advice from HTAs. Is that right?
The offer has been around for quite some time, over the last 10 years. But I think you're very much right that the frequency with which manufacturers are going to seek scientific advice is increasing. I remember myself many years ago, 10 years ago or so, working on a NICE scientific advice, but that was very much in the infancy. These days, with the introduction of the formal processes in Germany, Sweden, in the UK, but also with the UNETA process that I've just described, I think we're seeing a real acceleration in the number of assets that are going to early scientific advice with HTAs. And this is only hearsay, so we can take it for what that's worth. But in my experience in Europe, it is now increasingly expected by the HTAs that manufacturers take advantage of this opportunity. I get the sense from discussions that I've had at conferences and in other interactions that the HTAs feel increasingly that if you do not take advantage of this opportunity, there is no excuse to be given when you do not provide the evidence they need down the line. So I think over the last 2 to 3 years, it's really accelerated. Before then, it was not used anywhere near as much as in the regulatory setting.
In your observation, is the quality of scientific advice provided by HTAs high caliber, comparable caliber to that provided by regulatory agencies over the years?
I think it's fair to say that the more experienced the HTAs are in giving the scientific advice, the higher quality that gets. And I think that's the same for any sorts of advice. I think that's certainly the same probably for regulatory advice as well. But I would also say it depends upon the quality of the information that's provided by the manufacturer or by whoever is seeking the scientific advice. If you are asking it at the time of phase two trial design and you provide very limited information to the HTAs, then it's very difficult for them to give you good advice. On the other hand, if you give them information around the evidence plan that you're developing, the background, and provide some materials to help them understand what you're trying to do, I find that the level of advice can actually be very, very strong.
This is rather similar to what many regulators have said to manufacturers for many years. Come and see us early, and certainly before you launch your phase three program. So it sounds like the HTAs are giving similar advice to manufacturers. Come and see us early.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that different HTAs have different definitions of early, but certainly there's an expectation that companies come before the pivotal trial design or the registrational trial design is finalized. Now, of course, this is very much a European focus, given the role of health technology assessment in reimbursement decisions across Europe. But I think that it may expand to other jurisdictions in future as well.
If we stay with Europe, do you know whether manufacturers are in fact taking up this call to action by the HTAs and actually, you know, seeking scientific advice from HTAs relatively early in development? Is this happening?
Yes, it is increasingly. I remember at the recent Health Technology Assessment International conference that seeing that the statistics provided by the UNETA organization to, about the level of scientific advice being sought. And since the new procedure was put into place, I believe, towards the end of last year, there have been more than 30 applications that have been completed or are currently in process, which is a significant increase and actually higher than they expected. This is even without the number of manufacturers that are going to the national level discussions with NICE or with GBA or with TLV in Sweden. So yes, I think increasingly manufacturers are taking advantage of this in order to get insights on the requirements of a key stakeholder in the reimbursement process.
I think this conversation really has to do, it seems to me, with collaboration among manufacturers, regulators, HTAs, payers, to make sure that drugs in development are, in fact, going to be developed successfully and made available to patients in timely fashion. So collaboration seems to be a theme here. Would you agree?
It's a key theme. We're all of us are key players in the healthcare system. We're all key stakeholders in the healthcare system. And if decision makers, whether they be regulators, whether they be health technology assessment agencies, whether they be payers, whether they be patients or whether they be physicians, or indeed any other stakeholder, need to have the best information on which to make those decisions. And collaboration is a key driver, not just to make sure that we understand the needs of different stakeholders within the healthcare sector, but also to understand how best to meet the needs. And one of the stakeholders we didn't mention in this was the academic community. And I think that links very nicely back to the DIA meeting and the DIA study endpoints community. Without the outstanding work conducted by the study endpoints community, the scientific foundation of understanding how you can capture the value, how that can be translated into outcomes, isn't there. You need the scientific collaboration. You need the collaboration of people that understand what the endpoints mean to them, i.e. the patients and their caregivers. You need the collaboration with the people that are making decisions, either those that make decisions to perform drug development, so the pharmaceutical companies, or those that make decisions on registration or on reimbursement. And all of these parties are really important parts of the collaborative process to ensure that we get the best evidence in order to meet the needs of the decision makers.
So you would say the collaboration is not only nice to have, but in this day and age is a must have. Collaboration among all stakeholders in drug development, from clinicians to manufacturers to regulators to payers, must happen, or else patients would not get the medicines they need.
I think that's fair enough. I mean, I think that it's not possible to work in silos here because each of these elements is interconnected. We were talking at the beginning of the discussion around how study endpoints and outcomes interlink. Without the strong foundation, as I referred to it then, we can't understand how it is possible to capture value. Without transforming that into an understanding of what value represents, we don't know how decisions can be made, but also on what evidence needs to be generated to support those decisions. And without that understanding, people that make decisions aren't able to make those decisions on which are the best medical technologies to be given to patients. So in short, yes, the collaboration is essential.
And is happening. Today.
And is happening. There's a very vibrant community. I mean, and again, the DIA study endpoints community is a really good example of people from different backgrounds collaborating towards this common goal of making sure that the best medicines get to the patients who need them in the appropriate fashion.
Let's turn to the conference itself coming in September. One of the sessions you will share there is titled Current Payer Perspective on the Value of Study Endpoints. Can you share with us some of the salient points that are likely to arise from this session?
Yes, I can give a little bit of a taster of what we'll be discussing. We've got a fantastic faculty for this session. We have Elise Berliner from the Agency of Healthcare Research and Quality, and we have the inputs of Sean Tunis from the Center of Medical Technology Policy. So we've got a couple of really strong perspectives here. What we're going to be doing here is to define the requirements for study endpoints and to highlight how these requirements relate to decision-making, not just for patient access to medicines and to medical technologies, but also to other key stakeholders, as we've just been describing. And also, what's interesting as well is the differences between different decision-makers in different jurisdictions. So a study endpoint that translates to an outcome that may drive decision-making in one jurisdiction may not actually drive decision-making in another jurisdiction. And again, there are those that illustrate value but do not drive decision-making in their own right. So we're looking to differentiate and to illustrate these differences. And I think importantly, as with all of these meetings, we're looking to highlight the future requirements for study endpoints. So not just look what the situation is today, but looking at what the situation is likely to be in the next 3 to 5 to 10 years.
And what is the situation likely to be in 3 to 5 years? Any insight at this point, or do we need to wait for the conference?
You need to wait for the conference. The thing I should say about this meeting is that with Sean, Donna, his colleague that will also be joining, and Elise, you've got a very strong and opinionated faculty. But we're also hopefully going to have a very strong and opinionated audience. And so the perspectives will be given from those of the faculty, but we're really hoping to provoke the discussion amongst the audience so that we can come to a combined viewpoint on what those requirements may be over the next 3, 5, 10 years.
What about the voice of the regulators at this conference, whether in this session or other sessions? FDA has a study endpoints task force, and so are they going to be present and contributing to these discussions?
Yes, we do have representatives of the FDA. We've got the representatives of other key academics who specialize in this area. I should really point out session 4, and this is being led by my colleague Ashley Slagle. And we have 2 representatives of the FDA to talk about the 21st Century Cures Act and to look at the use of drug development tools to support drug development process. So this is going to have a very strong FDA perspective, but we've also got others that will give regulatory perspectives from different jurisdictions as well. That's going to be a really exciting part of the discussion as well.
Finally, Michael, let me ask you this. Study endpoints generally measure response to therapy. Are there also endpoints that measure wellness or the absence of disease?
It's a really good question. When you're looking at wellness or that sort of area, obviously the health-related quality of life and utility measures, they can be used to measure the impact of treatment, but they can also be used in their own right to measure the level of wellness. The one thing is that this is maybe part of the future as well, because traditionally in the use of health-related quality of life, for example, and other patient-reported outcomes measures, we do need these to be validated scientifically. And traditionally, it's been more, the demand for these sorts of endpoints has been more from the HTAs, some from regulators, of course, as well, to measure the impact. So if the demand is moving towards more of an assessment on wellness, for example, then I think this is something that could develop over the next 3 to 5 years. But that's a great question to ask at the conference.
Very good. Well, speaking of the conference, let me thank you, Michael, for your time today. And I wish you much good luck with the conference and great success, attendance, and thoughtful discussion.
Thank you very much, Alberto. Thank you very much for the conversation. I've enjoyed it very much.
For DIA Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.